somebody help, not just anybody help. You know I need someone help.
Okay, okay. It's Sunday night, and we are ready for another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. So glad you joined us tonight. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio, and across the studio is George P. Fraser, who is a bit of a conspiracy theorist who believes the hen was first, then the egg. Hello, George.
Bill, good to be here.
George, I imagine you spent your day in prayer and ritual cleansing.
I did.
Good, good. Nice to
see you. Sunday, isn't it?
Nice to see you. George, a small chunk of bad news. Let's just get this out of the way. The station has decided to pass on our proposal. The Bill and George bobbleheads have been scrapped due to 104% lack of interest. How do you go above 100%? See, to me, that was a stab in the eye.
It's disappointing.
We had it laid out. It was going to be a big marketing hit. And the Real Recovery bobbleheads and the whole idea is in the tank.
Well, we could have given them away to callers.
Yeah, and if you want to call tonight and be part of the program, please get your phone handy. It's 1-877-933-2484. We have in studio tonight Dr. Glenn Pickering, one of our very favorite guests.
He's my favorite guest, yeah. Unless Todd's listening tonight. Todd. No, I always like it when Glenn's on here because he has such a different approach that is biblically based. I learn something every time.
Yeah. George, tonight we're going to talk about other people in the relationship with the addicts, the codependent people, the people that are suffering, the people that are in a relationship with someone who needs recovery because they're suffering a lot, and they're trying to do things to make it better, and oftentimes what they do is making things worse. Is that often the case that you understand, George?
Well, I think my bias is that everyone is in recovery, so they need to work their own program, and how that looks with somebody else who has a problem is what we're going to talk about tonight. So I think it's going to be a very good show.
Okay, now let's talk about step 12, because every week on Real Recovery, we pick one of the 12 steps, and we talk about it, and it's biblical foundation and base, and tonight's no exception. We're going to talk about step 12.
We are going to talk about step 12.
Step 13 next week.
No, we're not going to talk about step 13 on our show, Bill, and I'll fill you in on that in the break. But okay. Here's where we go on step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we carried this message to others who were suffering and practiced these principles in all our affairs. In the first part, this is how we work out our Christianity. Do you remember the four spiritual laws? I think it was Campus Crusade, that you fall short, Christ is the bridge. That's basically what our program is doing, is we're looking that we do fall short in one and two, and we make a decision for Christ in step three. Then we do our inventory, and we work through, we make amends, we continue to do this, we seek God's will for us. And when we get to 12, we want to say, have I had an awakening? Has God touched me? Has my life changed? And if it has, God doesn't save anybody just to save them. He has a job for you to do to tell others what he has done in your life. That's how we glorify God, and our existence is to glorify God. And then we work this in all our affairs. We don't say, well, you know, I still have a gambling problem, but I haven't had a drink in a couple years. When we do step three, where we make a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of Christ, it's all things are captive to Christ. All things come under his authority. And that's what we have to do in our relationships and at work and at church and in all areas. We don't just stop a behavior. That's why this is such an important step, Bill.
George, I know we've got a lot to talk tonight with Glenn. So I would almost suggest we get started.
I think we get there right now.
Yeah, because we have lots and lots of questions. So, Glenn, welcome back to the program. Glenn,
thank you.
Dr. Glenn Pickering is a counselor, and he is an author, a speaker. His website is tagfreeliving.com, and he's one of our favorite resources. And we're always glad when you're on the show because you bring an angle to recovery that, George, you've never heard before.
Well, I still think it's step 10, being in this 30-plus years. It says we continue to take our personal inventory, and when we're wrong, we promptly admit it. And Glenn said on the show, wrong doesn't mean you're bad. It just means you're wrong. That was huge for me, Glenn.
I'm glad.
Well, George, I don't know if C.S. Lewis said that or Spider-Man, but it's whatever it is, somebody has to stop it. That's probably Spider-Man.
Okay.
So what, you know, what you have to do is stop some of the thinking that you've had, and Glenn will help us.
Okay.
Yeah.
We should bring him in right now.
Somebody has to save this show. That's how he's doing.
I just think it's you know, I think it's time to bring him on.
Well, here's a great thing. When you were reading about step 12, I just thought today about, oh, Mike Schultz, if you're listening, he was preaching today at our church. And he was talking about the I am the vine passage. And one of the things he said is, if you look at any tree, any vine that bears fruit, it doesn't bear fruit for itself. That fruit's of no use to it. It's for the other animals and the other creatures and the other parts of the world. So it's like, so we ask God to be pruned, to grow like crazy, to bear fruit, not because that fruit's for us, but for other people. And so when you're reading about step 12, it's like, right. In the 12 steps, we understand, yeah, you need to get your own self straight. That's true. But you're not getting your own self straight just for your own self. But then step 12, you go out and tell everybody else about it so that they can also get their life together.
This is why it's award-winning, George.
I think that's just great. And we carry that a lot of times by loving people, not talking
right.
to them.
It's so true. It's so true. There were lots of people who earlier in my life tried to convert me and actually drove me further from the faith because I thought, boy, if that's what the faith actually looks like, I don't want to be part of that. And the people who really, really, really helped me live my faith, that people have really literally lived out their faith in front of me in powerful ways. So, yes, it's not just about preaching.
Glenn, here's something I read this week by Dr. Tim Keller. He said, bad evangelism says, I'm right, you're wrong, and I would love to tell you about it.
Yeah,
yes. That sounds a little bit like what you just said.
Yes, yeah, even people... though you're not interested and I have to force you to listen.
Yeah. So, Glenn, we want to talk tonight about people involved in the lives of people struggling with addictions
right. And
their role when a problem arises or is revealed in a relationship. I know the person with the problem has got to address their issue,
right. But
let's talk a little bit about what the other person or persons, because extended family is involved in this as
sure.
well.
Right.
If somebody crashes the bus, there's a lot of people on it that have
right.
got, you know, neck trouble now. So
right.
how does it get dispersed among the flock?
Well, that's a really great question, and I think there are sort of two separate answers, both of which are true. So if I have somebody in my life who's going through a really traumatic problem, I need to first ask my question, how can I be supportive of them? How can I be encouraging to them? How can I encourage that they use this crisis, which is probably happening in their life, in some way to be good? So when the Apostle Paul writes in Romans 8 about how in all things God works to bring about the good, even if that person crashes somehow, and you know, maybe it's a crisis, maybe it's upsetting to all the rest of us, we still need to be clear, yeah, if we're really on a godly path, something amazing could come out of this, that God creates that possibility, and we have to be supportive in that way as opposed to blaming, which it's so easy to get into that sort of blaming kind of mode, like how could you have been doing that? The second thing we need to just be clear is, okay, and if I wasn't going to take your inventory, but was going to use this also, not just as a way that you could be transformed, but a way that I could be transformed also, and I'm really, really open to asking God, how could I be transformed? What part of this process might I have been playing into? And then to be open to listening to what that might be, because it's so easy to look at the person who has a problem and think, yeah, they had the problem. And that's half right. I mean, that is true. They do. But somehow all the rest of us are part of that pattern. And we need to ask ourselves, what role of that was I playing? And how do I need to change my part of that, whatever that might be?
In your book, Tag, which I read many, many times, you say, and I don't have the book in front of me, so I'm not going to quote it exactly, but a great question to ask is, what part of my behavior contributes to this issue?
Right.
And that's a pretty vulnerable question to ask, because
right. The
other person is probably so mad that
right.
this person is
right.
in this situation that to actually offer something that loving is quite a statement.
It is. And I think... But I need to be a little careful how I talk to people about that, because if I'm not careful, it sounds to them like I'm saying the addictive person's behavior is their fault, which, of course, that doesn't make any sense. So I want to be clear about that. But when I talk to people about 50-50, by which I mean, for example, in a marriage, that we get into marriage kind of relationships with people who have very similar strengths to ours and the flip side of our weaknesses. So if there's a problem in our relationship, I can look at the other person and think you're the problem. But I have to be willing to ask myself, but what's the flip side of that? What was my part of that? So, for example, if I'm in a relationship with someone who's really, really irresponsible, there's a very high likelihood that I, for example, am over-responsible, perhaps even to the point of being controlling. And, George, I know you were talking about that a little bit before we came on the air today.
I was.
You were. So say something about that.
Well, I want to... go back here,
because
it's interesting to me. I think we've got to be very clear, at least for me,
right. yep.
somebody who's a recovering alcoholic, if I'm in a relationship with somebody, I want to make it really clear that I don't believe there's anything they can do that's going to get me to go back to drinking.
Right.
And there's nothing that they really can do to, if they don't do it, I won't get sober. And I think that's right. Something we got to really drive home.
It is, because that's really about the other person's 50. For example, I work a lot with guys who are chemically addicted or sexually addicted. And oftentimes they'll say to their wife, he's addicted to alcohol or to drugs or to sex, and you're addicted to him.
Okay.
So, yeah, he has to get his part right about getting clean about the alcohol or the drugs or the sex or whatever that is. But you also have to give up thinking you're in charge of him.
Yeah, but just to get back to the point, mm-hmm. the behavior change on the addict or, mm-hmm. you know, person, it's up to them.
Right,
it doesn't
absolutely.
Matter what the other person does. Now, they can be really helpful.
Right.
But, I want to make it clear that right. my recovery isn't dependent on anybody else's behavior.
Right, and the part I was trying to get at, which is totally consistent with that, I promise, is that it's easy for the codependent person to think it is.
Yes.
That if I just get myself out, if I do the right things, if I say the right things, if I control you in the right way, manipulate your surroundings, or lie for you, or make things right, or cover things up, or somehow then that will be helpful to you, or that will make you not be the way you are. And so that's part of what I'm trying to say, that under-responsible people tend to marry, for example, people over-responsible. But so the under-responsible addicted person, yeah, their job is to step up and say, just like you did, hey, my life is up to me. I need to run my life.
Okay.
But the codependent person also needs to understand the same thing. Oh, I get it. It's your life. It's not up to me to run your life. The codependent person has to get that's not my job to run your life. In fact, they need to understand. In fact, I probably have to get better at taking control of my life instead of trying to run yours.
And is that hard for some people to not want to run their life?
Yes, exactly. I come from a very codependent caretaking background, so I really get this part, that it's way easier to see what everybody else is doing wrong and how they should do it and what they should all be doing. It's way easier to do that than just step up, be really vulnerable, claim my calling, and actually start living that out. That takes a lot more courage, I got to tell you.
Okay, if you are living with a person struggling with addiction and you've been banging your head against the wall and you want to know the best way to repair that drywall, give us a call, 1-877-933-2484. We can take calls tonight. We'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Real Recovery. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you had a great weekend. We have in studio tonight Dr. Glenn Pickering, and George, he's probably the smartest person I know. And trust me, I can say that because I know a lot of dumb people.
That's a high compliment.
Yeah,
that's nice.
Yeah. And I'm looking your direction.
Well, he's definitely the smartest one in this room, isn't he?
Yeah. Hands down.
It's always great to have him. This is a great topic.
Yeah, if you are dealing with someone in an addictive cycle, and you're going crazy, and you want you have a question for Dr. Pickering, please give us a call, 1-877-933-2484. We'd be thrilled to take your question. So, George, you had a question right for him before we went to break, or did you finish that one?
Well, you know, I finished that one, that we have to work our own side of the street, but how does the codependent person not be victim-y and then tie into the other person's behavior as reason for their own? How do you do that dance?
Like, give us a real specific, because that's a great conversation. Give us a specific. It'll help us focus that conversation.
I see a lot of people that are adults whose parent was an addict or alcoholic. And interesting, a lot of them try to get into the recovery ministry.
Right.
And they haven't resolved the anger and disappointment that they had with their parent. And they pass it along to people that are still suffering, like they're angry at them,
right.
And it's a transference of that, of an unresolved childhood issue, and like it feeds on them that it's hurting them what these other people are doing, and has no connection at all.
Right. That's a great illustration. I'm glad you were so specific. So I'm just going to take that one for a moment. A lot of times, for example, if a kid grows up in an alcoholic family, they're praying to God that the alcoholic quit drinking or quit using drugs. They beg the other person to quit drinking or quit using drugs. They tell everybody that they wish that was going to happen. They're always asking their mom or their dad to quit drinking or to stay home. And when that doesn't happen, then that kid at a very early age discovers that whole thing about lack of control. Mm. Like, there are some things I want to be in control of that I'm not. And it can make them very disappointed and very angry because that's not how it should be. You know, and from a kid's perspective, that makes total sense. It's not how it should be. I mean, this is not what anybody would, this is not how anybody would draw it up. So then when they go into the ministry, like you said, if they still have those issues, then they're going to be just as mad at all those recovering people who are also not getting it together, or if they ever make a mistake, or if they ever don't be serious about their recovery, they're going to bring that same anger into it, like they're everybody else's judge and jury. And then, yeah, they're your friend as long as you're acting correctly. But as soon as you have a lapse or a relapse or a struggle of some sort, suddenly that prosecuting attorney comes out, and we start having one of those ugly interactions.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the motivation there is good, is to try to help other people mm-hmm. not go through what they went through, but it right. seems like they never resolve that for themselves.
Right, and yes, I think that's so true. So I just think all of us who do counseling of any sort, I mean, we got to work hard on our own stuff.
Yep.
Because otherwise we just bring our own stuff in, that whatever it is we're trying to do to quote-unquote help somebody else. So if I grew up in that alcoholic family, in that sort of codependent kind of role, then I need to go someplace and work out what it means, what I'm in control of and what I'm not, what's mine to be in charge of and what's not, what my boundaries are and what they're not, and how to deal with my anger when other people don't do the way things the way I think they ought to do. Because if I don't address those issues, then I'm just going to carry them into whatever ministry or counseling I do, and that will indeed be unhelpful.
And we all do that anyway, don't we?
One way or another.
Yeah.
Glenn, what about when grandparents, for example, are witnessing what's going on with their kids and grandkids?
Right.
And now they're a generation removed.
Right.
They're not in the household.
Right.
But they're suffering beyond belief.
Right. I think I was actually just talking to a bunch of people at Grace Church in Edina about a very similar thing to that when I was able to go talk to them about parenting their adult kids. And one of the things they said was that the difference between help and control is help that nobody's asking for.
Control is help
that nobody's asking for.
Write that one down.
I am going to write it down.
It's the answer to an unasked question. And so if you come in and start telling people what they should do, even if you're right, so I'm not trying to be critical, but nobody's actually asking that question, you'll be doing nothing except upsetting everybody else in that equation, and then you'll walk away thinking, I don't get why they're so mad at me. Well, they're so mad at you because nobody's asking the question that you're trying to answer.
But you clearly see things going
right.
on that
Absolutely.
Are painful, and if
right.
it involves a grandkid, you're even suffering
I
more.
I know.
It's so what are you supposed to do?
Well, here's what I think we can do. We can share our perspective. So, for example, well, let me start here, and then we'll come back to the grandparents. Let's say I'm with a friend of mine who just lost somebody close to them. If I'm healthy and not codependent, then I'm like, oh, I'm really sad. I hurt for you. I'd be glad to pray for you. I'm sad for you that you're sad. That's perfect. That's healthy. If I'm codependent, I think I got to fix that. I got to make them not sad. I got to cheer them up. I got to, like, then instead of being with them in their grieving, I think I have to fix their grieving. Like, I take responsibility for what they do with that grieving instead of just letting it be. Okay, so I can say I'm sad for you, and that's true. As soon as I say I'm sad for you, so what you should do is, see, now I just crossed that line. So it's the same thing if I'm a grandparent. I can say to one of my kids, you know, I'm worried about X, Y, or Z. That's just true. I'm just telling you. This is how it is for me. This is what I see. I'm worried about X, Y, or Z. I don't cross any lines when I do that. But as soon as I say, so starting tomorrow, you should, oh boy, see, now I did cross that line. Now I'm trying to be in control of somebody else's life, and that will go badly.
I still don't know if I know what to do.
But what I do is I speak up for what I see, and then I'm done. By which I mean, see, there's a difference between discernment and judgment. And discernment is, here's what I see.
Do you share that if you're not asked?
I can share my discernment. I just can't share what to do about it. But even that might still come across as controlling if I'm not careful, yes.
Okay, and one thing we always can do is pray, of course. But it almost sounds to me that the codependent position a lot of times is very victim-y, but in a way it could be very egotistical because not only is this problem, I'm the guy to fix it. Is
exactly.
that fair?
See, that's the part that I'm trying to say. That's where we move from help to control. That if my friend says I'm really sad and I think I'm sad for you, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as I think, well, I should fix that, I know the answer. Here's what you should do. See, I'm starting to act like I have the answer for their life, and A, I'm not God, so I don't have the answer for their life. And then if they don't do what I say, then I'm going to feel victim-y and powerless. So that's why it's perfectly fine to have my perspective. It's personally fine to share my perspective, but as soon as I start telling people what they should do, given that I have that perspective, see, then I'm pressed, then there is boundaries getting stepped on.
So I could say I'm concerned about what I'm seeing.
Absolutely. And then I'm done.
Okay.
When Jesus said, he would so often preach, teach, do some healing, some sort of powerful act, and then he would say, basically, he who has ears, let him hear. So I'm going to teach you what I know, I'm going to do what I can, and then I'm done. And you're going to listen or you're not, you're going to follow me or you're not, you're going to tell your neighbors or you're not. So if I see a problem and I say, hon, here's a concern I have, I need to think, he who has ears, like, I need to be done now.
But then you've got your own soothing of your own anxiety when you get done with that interaction, because that may not feel very satisfying.
Right. Yes. If satisfying means I got people to do what I thought they should do, then I'm in that codependent way of thinking. If I really realize satisfying is at the end of the day, me and God have prayer time, and God said, did you do what I asked you to do? Yes. Great. I need to be clear. Satisfying means I saw a place I needed to say a word. I said that word. And then I stop.
Okay, so part of that might be, in hearing this, that I think I know better than you do about
right.
what you need to
exactly.
do, and I'm not supposed to share that.
Exactly, and it's always going to go badly. I mean, the other person will always feel denigrated, put down, less than, right, because that is what I'm saying to them.
A lot of wisdom there. You got to think about it a little bit in that my job, I guess, is mm-hmm. to share a concern.
Right.
And, Bill, you and I have worked with guys over the years. One of the things I always try to do, and I learned this the hard way, is to ask first, are you asking me what I think?
Right, yep.
Because we want to have people in our lives that have permission to tell us.
Right.
And, Bill, you're one of them in my life. And I haven't had permission in your life, but I tell you anyway because I care. But here's the deal. That's hard because we really have to trust God then to work on it when we could do a better job ourselves if we got in there, right?
We're so sure that that's true, aren't we?
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Well, what is iron sharpens iron, one man another? Where does that fit into this equation?
Well, see, what I think is, what they're trying to say is, my love and your love will shape each other in a really powerful way. So if I'm concerned for you, then I get to say, Bill, I'm really concerned about this, and here's how come. Great. That's me sharing my discernment, using whatever wisdom I have to try and be of help to you. But then I need to also understand that if I step in and start running your life and telling you what to do, I'm not making you stronger. I'm making you weaker.
Well, it also becomes more about me than you.
Well, that's part of the problem. So then I'm not actually doing that to help you or to sharpen your iron. I'm doing it because of my anxiety, because I think I need to be in charge of something to feel safe. So I'm not actually doing it for you. I'm actually doing it for me. And that's where we get stepped over that line.
Addicts will be very defensive when they're confronted by any person loving them that's trying to tell them the truth.
Right. Which is, but yes, that's absolutely true. But it's also true, it's important to remember from the codependent place that sometimes they get all defensive because I am being judgmental or attacking or stepping over the line or telling them what to do. And they have a right to be reactive to that because that's not my place.
Just to put a qualifier, not all addicts, not all codependent people. There's a tendency for
right,
that,
absolutely.
But I don't think it's an absolute.
Right. Every single one of us are our own unique selves.
And people react differently. I guess what I'm getting from this is I'm responsible for a boundary effort to communicate in love
right.
what I'm seeing and let it go at that.
Exactly. That is what I can do, and
that's
I am
hard.
Responsible for that. It is hard.
Especially when you're as competent as we are.
Right. It's easier always for us humans to go one extreme or the other. So it'd be easier to say nothing or to step in there and start telling everybody exactly what to do and run their life. The middle ground, which is where God always calls us, where I don't be quiet, I speak in truth, and then I quit and let go of it from there, that middle place where I'm not quitting and I'm not taking on too much power, but just when I'm just responsible for what I'm responsible for, that's what God calls us to do, and that's always the hardest thing to do.
Because nothing is getting fixed.
Right.
And we want something fixed,
well,
some results somewhere.
It's not that it's not getting fixed, it's that it's not getting fixed by us, and our little ego gets kicked in and thinks it wants it to be about us.
And there can be some punitive things there,
exactly,
too, where you're getting
right,
damages.
So, yep,
you know,
yep.
I want a little power here, too, so here's what we're going to do. You're going
right.
to do this, this, and this.
Right.
But I love you, and I do, but, you know,
right.
I'm in some pain here.
Right, exactly. And so in that pain and in our anxiety, we reach out and try and do more than is really our place to do. So that's why I say that tough place that God calls us to is to speak the truth and then be done.
Okay. Go ahead, Bill.
George, in the intellectual hierarchy of
well said.
Thank you. In this room, we're just, so you know, we're down towards the bottom, you and me.
Thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Well, you're welcome.
But, sense of belonging, really.
Sense of belonging. And based on that, we're going to take a little short break. When we come back, lots more with Dr. Glenn Pickering. Thanks for being with us tonight on Real Recovery. Hope you're enjoying the show. Don't go anywhere unless you have to. And then
come back.
Then, yeah, we'll miss you, but come back. Thanks. We're back, Real Recovery, in studio. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio, and across the way, semi-retired super mogul George Fraser. We have in studio tonight Dr. Glenn Pickering, and we're talking about if you are in a relationship with someone who has an addiction, you've got a part to play in this as well. And if you're struggling with something and want to ask a question, feel free to give us a call at 1-877-933-2484. This whole thing about codependence, Glenn, you're killing me with that, because I'm seeing myself all over the place, because my first default reaction is to want to make a person feel better and fix it and tell a joke, make them laugh, trying to get them distracted, get them off their game, get them in a different place. And I can sometimes do that successfully, and then I go home completely wasted. And right. But I pat myself on the back going, hey, you did a good job.
Right.
But, you know, after a while, you start to go, that's exhausting.
Right, because you didn't actually do a good job. I hate to be the one to tell you.
That's okay.
No, I don't mind, really. But here's what I keep thinking about. So the word compassion, which is what we call to have compassion for those in our life, means co-passion. And they mean passion like the passion of Christ, like suffering. So if somebody in our life is struggling and we have compassion, that means we struggle with them. But see, if I'm breaking their mood, telling a joke, trying to get them to be cheerful, notice I'm not struggling with them. So I'm not only not letting them have their struggle, I'm not willing to be in that struggle with them. So neither one of us now is going to be sad because I'm so busy distracting you. So it's important to remember, even if I am trying to be comforting to people, being with them in that struggle is what's actually comforting.
35-year career just...
out the window.
Just out the window.
Have to start
that
over.
Fast.
But
yeah.
There are openings now in a lot of other careers you can be.
Well, this world needs ditch diggers, too.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah.
That was quick. Yeah.
Right.
That requires some work, though. That could be a problem. When I was doing an internship for my counseling, I was sitting in a family group, and a lady started crying during the group, nothing unusual, and I handed her a box of Kleenex. And afterwards, the supervisor said, I want to tell you why you did that and why I don't want you to do that.
Right.
So the reason you did that wasn't for her. It's because you were uncomfortable and you wanted to stop hurting yourself. Next time, let her get it herself and let her cry. Right. It's not about you. And I was really mad about it. Uh-huh. Driving home in the car, I realized he's right. Yeah. That a lot of this is about us, and we don't want to feel the feelings of the pain, so we want to fix them so we stop hurting.
Right, exactly. And if we're actually going to have compassion, then we have to let ourselves hurt with them, which is hard. I get that.
That fit at all?
Well, it does fit, but if a person is doing something stupid and you're mad at them, how do you fellowship in their suffering with them?
It was a really clear example, because this would be a great conversation.
So the person is, it finds out, you find out that your partner is going to the casinos. And they just lost $20,000 of our life savings.
Right.
And they did that behind my back.
Right.
And I'm mad.
Right.
It's her problem, but now it's our problem.
Right.
And I don't know how I come along and deal with that compassionately when all I want to do is scream.
Right. See, here's the thing. If your partner has gambled away $20,000, they probably feel like crap. And it's your job to understand that they probably do feel like crap. And you're really upset that they did it, and it's their job to understand that you feel really upset that they did it. In other words, if we're both going to step out of that codependence stuff and actually be with each other in some authentic relationship, then I'm going to understand that you did that because you were hurting, and I can feel for you. And it's your job to understand that it's really upsetting that you didn't come to me and talk to me about the fact that you were hurting, and then instead you went and spent $20,000 of our money, and you need to understand, I need to understand how much you were hurting, and you need to understand how much your way of fixing that hurting was upsetting to me. And those are both true.
That's way too mature. Isn't it, George?
No, I think I could handle getting the point across that I was upset about it. I think I could do my part. But then you got to let go of it, don't you?
You have to let go of it. And you also, the other half of your part is to also understand, and I get that you didn't actually do that to be mean to me or hurt me, even though I am upset. You did that because you're so hurting and you didn't know what to do with yourself.
So what are we going to do from here then, huh?
So exactly. So how are we going to do this thing differently so we don't keep being in this pattern where you have this struggle, you're in a lot of pain, and you don't think I'm safe enough to talk to about that?
Sounds like you need a third party that's neutral.
Or somebody to help you get better at having that conversation, yes. But again, it's important to understand, both of us have something we need to get better at. And if we, it's not that if my partner is the one with a gambling problem, I'm not going to say, hey, I'm going to take responsibility for the fact that you have a gambling problem. I am going to take responsibility for the fact that you were feeling really isolated, really lonely, really disconnected, and didn't feel like it was safe to talk to me. There must be some things I've been doing to make me not safe to talk to, and I want to get better at that part.
So how much micromanagement should go on with the person that's gambling by the other person? Because the other person is now livid. I'm going to monitor every move you make.
Right.
Every unaccounted for 5 minutes, I want to know what you were doing.
Right. And it's really important to remember that thing I said at the beginning about how often when I talk to sex addicts, I say, if I'm talking to a sex addict guy and his wife, that he's addicted to sex and she's addicted to him. So he keeps telling me he's in control of his addiction, which of course he's not, and she keeps thinking she's in control of him, which of course she's not.
Mm.
So when the addiction comes out, you know, his first thought is to be relieved. Oh, thank goodness somebody finally found out so I don't have to keep doing that anymore. Her first thought is, I got to be really, really more in control of you. And so just like he has to learn, oh, I got some letting go here, that she's going to have to come to the same understanding. Oh, I get it. My attempts to be in control of you haven't been working any better than your attempts to be in control of your sexuality. We both have to do some step one work here where I really get I'm not in control of this thing.
I like that. I have to admit I'm powerless and this is unmanageable. And that's what step one is, Bill, not just for the person, let's say, that has the addiction, but the person who's in the relationship with them. They have their own stuff.
Right.
And they're powerless. I got to tell you, I have one codependent thing that I can think of in a relationship with somebody that is really struggling with what they're doing. And I remember a couple weeks ago I said to somebody, you know, if they don't make it, I don't know if I'm going to.
Wow.
And I heard myself say that, and I was like, boy, okay, we've got some work to do here.
Right.
It was just an honest statement.
Right,
now,
absolutely.
You know, indicating the level of the pain.
Right.
And I'm sure there's a lot of people listening who feel that.
Right.
And so there is work to do, and step one for me is I am powerless over that person and what they do.
Exactly. Exactly right. And so when I say that both the addictive person in recovery and their partner, hey, you both have to learn how to let go of stuff that's not yours to be in charge of, and that this is where I really, really believe in that God wants to be on your team and wants to be helped you, and this is where you really start taking that relationship seriously, is so important. Because the sex addict thinks that sex is the solution to their problem, and the one who's married to him thinks being more in control of you is the solution to this problem. And those are both so incorrect.
Okay, so you realize you're codependent and you have some issues. You don't just stop this thing and say a few magic prayers and then we're good to go. What do you do?
Well, for me, that's been a lifetime of work, so I don't want to sound like it's, you know, by next Tuesday this will not be an issue for you guys. But I know this. It's been about more and more and more and more about really, really thinking about what I call life's most dangerous question, which is, what do you want? And so coming out of that codependent perspective, I was always watching everybody else. What do they need? What do you need? How can I fix your life? How can I be there for you? What do you need? And I've had to get way, way better thinking, no. What are my gifts? What am I called to do? What are the things that are incredibly fulfilling for me to do? And am I doing those things?
Okay. What if we don't know what we want to do, but we try to work a program where it says we're supposed to do what God wants us to do, and when we do that, somehow those things merge?
Right. Here's the really cool thing.
Is that fair?
Yes, in the most profound sense, because there's a place way inside me where me and God intersect, and prayer is a great place to get there, a great way to get there. And what I realize at that absolute center place in me is that what I want for my life and what God wants for my life are exactly the same thing. So there's not a conflict there. So I could say, what am I gifted at, or what does God want me to do? Except God is the one who gave me those gifts.
I like that. What about Al-Anon?
Al-Anon's great because it will help bring other people into your life who are working on some of that same stuff, where they're learning how, oh, I'm supposed to let go of running everybody else's life. I'm supposed to get way better taking charge of my life. I'm trying to figure out what's my vision, what's my calling, what are my gifts, how do I quit blaming everybody else for my stuff and just really start taking charge of my life. And the more I can surround myself with people who are on that kind of a healthy path, the better off I am.
You know, I'm sure I'm speaking for myself here, but there's a deep level of hurt here on some of these issues that I'm not really sure I want to look at.
Yeah, that's true. It's hard. I'm not saying that's going to be easy. I'm not saying it's easy for me. It's not.
But we stay stuck or we move forward. And I think about right. What Paul wrote in Philippians, that we got to press on towards the goal.
Right. So true. And it's not just for us. I used to read the parts in Exodus where God is saying, here's the commandments, you need to do those, and if you do, your life will be blessed. If you don't, then, you know, there will be pain through three generations. And I used to hear that back in the old days as being judgmental or harsh, but now I get, no, it's just true. I don't just need to get my life together for myself. There are people who come after me, and people will come after them, and people will come after them who will be affected by all the effort I'm putting into trying to get my life right. And so, yes, it is hard, and yes, it is painful. And it's important to remember, and we're not just doing it for ourselves. There are literally people who are counting on us to get this right, people who will be here after we're gone.
George, we just have a couple minutes to break, and we've got a caller on line one. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm just fine, thank you. My name is Ham.
Hey, Ham, good to meet you.
I'm a fan of Dr. Pickering. I've been to his seminars, and I just had a question I wanted to ask him, if that's all right.
No, fire away.
I dare you.
Thank you. What about if you feel that there's nothing wrong with, you know, some pornography, you know, as long as you're not carried away by it, that you have a close relationship with your spouse, and you know, this is just another part, and you're not, it's not that, it's not hurting anyone, you just feel that there's nothing wrong. Can you respond to that?
Yes, I think the tricky part of that slippery slope is this one. There are probably some people who are social drinkers. There are probably some people who really can just have a drink once in a while and have it not actually affect their life very much. But it's also true that every addicted person at some point thought that. So it's like, yeah, there's a slippery place there if you're not careful, and you can suddenly find a thing you thought was sort of this innocent part of your life that starts to take over your life. And I just think pornography is one of those things. There's a lot of power to anything that's about sex or food or money or relationships. And so we can easily, if we're not careful, find that this thing, which was just sort of an interesting part of our life, starts to take over more and more and more of our life.
It's a fire.
Is there some point at which you know you're in trouble?
Well, actually, George looks really thoughtful, so I'm thinking he has something to say about this.
Gosh, I'm going to be real cautious here. I've looked at it myself, okay? And I don't think any man that has seen pornography does not have a problem with it, in that I don't think it's honoring to God. And I think if I'm married and do it, it's adultery, and that's just me. I just can't think of any way that's honoring to God to do that. Mm. And I've done it, okay? And we've talked sometimes that our view of women growing up with Playboys and pornography is so away from what God had intended that it's really hard to get back on track. And I just can't see where that's going to help anybody's Christian walk. And I think if Jesus was here, he'd go, I don't want you to do that. Those are my daughters.
Mm.
And I don't mean that to be shaming. It's something I think all men who have seen pornography, and everybody I know has, struggles with it. It's just a real tool of Satan, I think. And I just think it's better to not do it.
Cool. Bill, what do you think?
And I appreciate the call. Gosh.
Yeah, Ham, yeah, thanks for calling. Actually, we have to go
to
break.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we have one more segment with Dr. Pickering. Thanks for joining us tonight on Real Recovery. Hope you're enjoying the show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Real Recovery. George, in Luke 9, it's Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me. And of course, that means being willing to die in order to follow Jesus. It's dying to self. It's an absolute surrender every day.
Daily.
Every day. After each time Jesus commanded, whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will save it. Now, what good is it for a man to gain the whole world yet lose his whole soul? That's what we're talking about tonight, is the need to pick up your cross and die to yourself. That's what every person struggling with an addiction has to do. And then the people around them have to figure out how to love them and support them.
Well, they also have to figure out how to die to themselves. If we think about what you guys have been talking about, that's easy to think, okay, I'm the codependent person, so I have to make sure you do all the right things. Well, see, I have to die to the thought that I'm in charge of you, that I know what's right for you, that's my place to run your life, and that I know what's best for you better than anybody else does. I mean, those are all prideful thoughts, and I have to die to that self.
And I think we got to die too, Doctor, that we're okay. Because I think right. Jesus said that right. for everybody.
Right, exactly. That's part of the dying to that prideful self. It's easy to be the codependent and look at the other one and think, yeah, you got the problem. And I think, no, we all got problems.
Well, I think one of the great things about being an addict, and I am one, is that we make headlines, okay?
Right. Yes.
But there's the other stuff, the anger, the lust, you know, the not doing what we could do for others that I guess so-called normal people would have as a problem. So I'm okay. My problem is not as bad as yours.
Right.
But they all fall short of the glory of God.
Right. And I'm just reading in Matthew 7 here, you know, about how Jesus said, you know, why do you see the speck in your brother's eye? You don't see the log in your own eye. And it's so easy for all of us coming from that codependent place that think, if I see the speck in your eye so clearly, why don't you take care of that speck that I keep arguing with you about? And Jesus is like, Glenn, how about if you first stop and look at all the things in your life that you're not as in charge of as you could be, all the things I keep asking you to do that you're not doing, and how about if you get better at letting go of all the stuff that's mine and not yours? Oh.
I hate that verse.
Mm-hmm. It's very convicting, isn't it?
Yeah. It is. Well, that kind of killed the show.
Yeah.
Next. Had some more music.
Can we have cinnamon girl? We had some momentum until that. Thanks, Glenn.
Good to have you on, Glenn.
Absolutely.
Thanks for bumming everybody out.
Now we're going to start a new show called Real Relationships.
I want to get back a little bit on the phone call, and I sure appreciate it. We were talking on the break. I think there's a part, and I think it's in Romans, about happy is the man who doesn't condemn anything he does. I always appreciate asking other people their opinion. I think that's great to actually take the effort to make a phone call and to check things out, because I'm real big on checking things out.
Right.
But in my gut, I got to know. And a lot of times, I'm looking for somebody to tell me it's okay when I know it's not. And I got to get back to the Word a lot of times, because I heard when you were and Bill did a show that you said the friends will always give you bad advice on relationships.
Yes.
And I almost called in on that because I said, you know, sometimes they give you good advice, not always. But I got your point. What does the Word say about that? And that's where we have to go all the time, don't we, Glenn?
Well, one of the things I love about Proverbs is it talks oftentimes about you should also always seek wise counsel. And since, you know, I'm a pastoral counselor, I think that's a great line. But I notice it always says you should seek wise counsel. And I think there are so many people who want to give me counsel about things in their life that already aren't working right. So people who really struggle financially who would say to me back when I started my own practice, well, Glenn, why don't you start your own practice? Why don't you just keep working for somebody else? Because you need the security. And I think, So basically, you who have messed up your own financial life are giving me financial advice. So I do want feedback from people, and I want advice from people, but I want advice from people who have done that thing well that they want to teach me about. So there are lots of people who can teach me about recovery, about relationships, about financial things. I just want to make sure that I'm getting counsel from people who are actually doing that thing in their own life effectively. And so often, and I see this all the time coming out of my own codependent background, is we want to give people advice about parts of our life that we ourselves are not doing very well, since we're not very good at asking life's most dangerous question, what do I want? So then we're in this weird position where we're telling other people how to run their lives when we're not running our own life very effectively.
So a healthy person would say, what do I want? A codependent would say, what do I have to do?
Right. Or, more twistedly, what do you want?
Okay. Just thinking out loud here, that sounds a little self-serving for codependent people, because I think they want what they want, too.
Right. And here's the really great thing. It's only in our human, black and white, either-or thinking mind that those are different, and here's what I mean. So Jesus tells this whole series of parables, and he ends up with the one about the mustard seed that starts off really large and grows in this big bush, because he's talking about what the kingdom of heaven is like. And most people who preach about that topic end with that sentence. But the story ends with, it grows into this big bush so that even the birds of the field can make nests in its branches. See, if I actually listen to God's call in my life, and I actually do what I'm called to do, it will be gratifying for me, it will be helpful to me, and it will powerfully affect the lives of everybody around me. So that even if all I wanted to do was something for somebody else, I would start still by asking, what's my calling?
Okay, can we roll back to the codependent thing real quick?
Yeah.
Because my codependent part, if I can compartmentalize, I know that's really healthy.
No, it's good.
Is if I'm supposed to love my neighbor as myself, I'm concerned about your problem. But the bottom line really is I want you to stop your problem because it's causing me pain.
Right.
So that's pretty selfish.
It's totally selfish. And that's why I've said, I mean, it's hard for those of us who come out of the codependent background like I do to understand that all the things that we try to do to fix other people's lives so we look very other-centered are totally self-centered.
That's probably why I want to do it so much.
And that, you know, if we actually drop that self-centeredness and really, really struggle with that whole different set of questions, like what is God calling me to do and how can I make sure I'm doing that, I actually quit being self-centered because that's actually the way to be of service to the people in my life.
Okay, so I want to be Christ-centered instead of self-centered, and I'm listening tonight. Actually, I'm on your program, okay? How do I do it? Mm. How do I start?
Right. Here's the thing I often talk to people about. We tend to ask the question, what am I called to do? As if there's this one really, really big answer to that question. Well, ignoring all the things that we're literally being called to do that are right in front of us every single day. And so here's what I know, and I would say this to any listener. If you're really, really struggling with the question, what are my gifts? What's my calling? Why am I here? I just ask you to just pay attention to each of the people that God brings into your life in the next 7 days. The person who comes to you with a question about who knows what. The person who stops and asks you how you're doing. The kid in your life who needs help with homework. And I just want you to notice, what are the things every single day that God seems to be calling you to do? What are the things that make you really joyful and happy when you do them? And you will notice there's a pattern to those things.
Okay.
And that's how I start to understand what's my overall gifts. I just notice what are the things that God seems to be asking me to do every day. What are the things I seem to be best at doing in those little teeny things every day? What are those things that bring me joy? And then I'll start to get a better sense of sort of what my overall picture might look like. Because that overall picture is really just a whole bunch of little teeny bricks in that wall.
Don't look at me, George.
I like to sleep and play golf. I don't know how I'm doing. But, yeah,
you
I like that.
Doing great.
Well, you know, we talk about that, Glenn, because what I really like to do, one of the things, is work with guys early in a recovery.
Right, exactly. And it brings you happiness. It brings you gratified.
Oh, yeah.
And so then I think, wait, so that's one of your callings. Now, people sometimes say, well, Glenn, I shouldn't just go by what makes me happy. And I think, no, you don't get it. That's how you know you're on the right track. Because it's not me or somebody else. It's not me against somebody else. It's not black and white, like I said. If I'm using my gifts, that's also the way I can bless other people. So if I'm really doing the things that make me joyful and bring me a sense of peace, I can be absolutely sure that's my best way to bless all the people around me. So you love working with people who are early in that recovery process. Well, guess what? That's also your best way to bless other people. Work with people who are early in their recovery process. You will bring the joy of that process with you in all that you do. You'll give them hope. They'll see that it's really possible. They'll see somebody who's recovering who seems so joyful and happy, and it will encourage them. It's a total win-win, but that's always true. If I use my gifts, it's a total win-win. That's what God always does.
Unfortunately, a lot of people I've been working with for years are early in the recovery process. So, but, Billy, you like going down there, too, and working with guys. You light up when you do it. That's one of the reasons we're here.
I do. I love seeing guys being at a place of incredible brokenness, and they're looking for hope. And if you bring them hope and give them Jesus, they start to respond, and you see that, and it's pretty wonderful.
Yeah, it is.
And here's the really cool thing. It's wonderful for them and for you.
Oh, there's no question.
If I use my gifts, that's what always happens. I touch other people's lives in this powerful way, and it's incredibly gratifying for me to be part of the process. So when somebody says, Glenn, what am I calling? What are my gifts? I'm looking for what are those things, just day in and day out, the little teeny things that make you happy, that make you feel like, hey, I touched somebody else's life in a way that also kind of lights you up on the inside. And that's a huge sign of where God is trying to lead you.
So, Glenn, any parting thoughts for the person sitting home tonight just feeling so frustrated that they can't penetrate getting into their loved one's mind and heart about their addiction?
Yes. Well, I... three very quick things to say. One, I get that that's hard. Two, you have to let go of thinking you're responsible for their recovery. Three, you have to really, really ask yourself, if God was using this as a situation to really, really bring about transformational change in my life, what might that look like?
That's been great. Glenn, as always, it's just so great having you on the show. Thank you. Pick a date on your calendar. Come back soon. You know you have an open invitation. In Psalm 105, it says, keep your eyes open for God. Watch for his works. Be alert for signs of his presence.
Nice.
Because you'll see them all over the place. If you're tonight struggling with somebody that you're in a relationship with, God bless you. Arms around you tonight. We love you. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, everyone. Good night and God bless.